Okay, our next presenter is Sharon Abbey, who is actually a member of the Brock University faculty. And Sharon teaches courses in social studies and women's studies and was the founding member of the Center for Collaborative Research. Some of her research interests include holistic education, reflective practice, women's studies and gender equity, maternal pedagogy, and images of motherhood, as well as narrative inquiry and embodied knowing. So I will welcome Sharon to the podium, and the title of her paper for us today, and remember I told you we were going to have some explorative type narrative. This may be one of those for us here. It's called Testimony as Reflective Transformation.
Thank you. Jonathan Quarry, I love you. I have been teaching for over 40 years, and I've always been a rebel. Started in elementary, went up, ended up in university. What you say is brilliant. Please make it happen.
It can. First of all, I must say that testimony is not my area of expertise. I feel a bit like an interloper this morning. But again, I'm a rebel. I'll do those kind of things. It is a kind of social justice paper, but social justice with a small S and a small J. It is an example of embodied writing. And I leave it to you experts in this field to deconstruct or theorize when I'm through. I do a lot with photography and photo scribing, so I have passed a few photos around which I'll make reference to. I didn't put them on a screen because they came off my shelves in my house and they needed to be intimate and they needed to be personal. So pass them around. The parts that I'm talking about are the disruptive parts, and I don't mean to imply that the healthcare system did not have a lot of caring people. But the disruptive parts are what stick with me, and the kindness and the good stuff kind of falls to the background. Maybe that's unfortunate, but I seem to learn from the disruptive parts. And there still are a lot of injustices that I think need to be given voice to and that we need to confront and do something about. My paper is in two parts. I'm going to read the first part, and the second part, I don't know who gets copies of all this, but excerpts from my journal are also in here. I'm not going to read all that part. And I'm truly humbled to be in the company of courageous survivors this morning, as well as really insightful theorists and philosophers and social activists. Thank you. My husband died 6 months ago. I am newly widowed. This is a solitary identity I did not expect to inhabit. It's difficult to navigate. I did not intend to write about this now or ever. My feelings are raw and visceral. This story writes itself, and the words find me as I spiral deeper into my soul to a place beyond words. Thoughts and feelings merge seamlessly like the Mobius strip with no beginning or end. The images and perceptions buried deep within my subconscious slowly trickle to the surface at first, and then they gush out fast and furious, piercing into another realm. I connect with the universe, and time stands still. It pools around me. Embodied writing like this just happens. It is unintentional. It's organic. It's all-consuming. It's urgent. It's compelling. It's neither temporal nor linear. It's not a literal retelling. I am my own research study, bearing witness to myself and into a much broader realm. In all the photographs, he looks at me adoringly. I miss being adored. I miss being loved. I miss the sound of his car in the driveway, his greeting at the door. I miss the sound of his voice, his laugh. I miss our dinners together. He would always light candles, ever the romantic. I miss sharing my day and seeking his advice over a glass of wine. He was grounded, wise, straightforward. He was a good listener, my confidant, my sounding board, my friend, my soulmate, my ski partner. I miss him singing out of tune in my ear as we danced. He would warn me to slow down and stop leading. How do I teach my heart to survive? How do I embrace aloneness? Well, it could be a good thing, I tell myself. Solitude has its advantages. I have a new place to explore, to enter into. I did not open the door to this terrifying space willingly. I was thrown through it at full force. I landed on my feet, but I don't really remember. I tried to embrace his death and welcome it as a joyful rebirth. I took handfuls of his ashes, felt the gritty fragments of bone amid the powdery texture, and threw the grayness into the air. Particles caught the reflection of the late autumn sun and sparkled magically. I gave him back to the universe. He belongs there. After he died, I packed up his belongings, tools, antiques, clothing, books. I dismantled his existence, our life together. Where does one end and the other begin? How seamlessly we had merged together. I had hardly noticed this happening. How do I extract a whole self, stay intact, and move on? How do I go forward and leave him behind? Why dwell on the 3 months of pain and suffering, the catastrophic stroke that snatched most of him away in an instant? He endured so much, at times with dignity and gracious patience. He also raged against his fate, what little he knew of it, with vicious outbursts, spitting out sounds that no longer formed words. He lost his ability to communicate on any level. Our collective memories were erased. Remember when is a hollow question now. It hangs in the air. Where do the memories go? The surgery was scheduled for 8 a.m. We got there early. I read the newspaper as we waited together in pre-op. We could have talked, but we didn't. It was no big deal. A routine procedure. He would heal and return to normal. But fate had other plans. His brain exploded. Reluctantly, I left the hospital late that night to go home. I was leaving everything I cared about behind. I no longer knew where home was or what it represented. Shortly after my husband died, I was invited to a wedding. I decided to go myself. This would be a challenge, a test to my ability to be on my own. I would meet new people and move beyond my comfort zone. To my dismay, I was seated at a table with single women and widows. All the other tables were filled with couples. Why was I segregated like this? I did not belong here, an outsider, relegated to the periphery, the margins. I had become uncoupled, like an out-of-control train speeding downhill without the brakes. When the tables were cleared for dancing, I left. I feared I would no longer fit in with our couple friends. My status had changed. Widows are awkward. Widows are overlooked and left out. These were stereotypes I intended to resist. I would not sit home and wait to be invited. I did not want to sit on the sidelines, so I invited two couples for dinner. I set the table with the good china and silver. I picked flowers from the garden, the yellow roses my husband had planted for me. The guests arrived, admired the table, and asked who else was joining us. I followed their gaze and realized I had automatically set the table for six. We decided to leave the empty chair. I'm crossing a border. I'm entering foreign space, unfamiliar territory. I am reluctant and I'm scared. I'm profoundly sad. Each step requires tremendous effort. Everyone around me seems to have a purpose or a routine. I've lost mine. My baggage has not arrived with me in this foreign destination. I really don't want to be here. I'm resentful. I remind myself that I'm strong, I'm independent, and I'm resilient. I repeat this mantra over and over as if trying to convince myself that this is the core of my identity and it cannot be taken from me. But how do I navigate this liminal space and protect who I am? I'm no longer an insider or an outsider. Instead, I occupy a third space somewhere in between. As Hall points out, that identity is a process. Identity is not fixed, but rather an ambivalent point. I am experiencing a sense of extreme dissonance. Becoming a widow has forced me to look inward, to examine the experiences of otherness, to make sense of my positionality. People ask me how I am doing. I don't mind the question, but it's the sympathetic, patronizing tone that bothers me. They seem to expect me to reply that I'm not doing well. They're waiting to sympathize, to shoulder my burden. How do you manage that big house all by yourself? Well, I like my big house, and I'm managing quite well. I try to sound upbeat and positive when, in fact, I'm somewhat resentful and confused. I refuse to feel sorry for myself, and I certainly don't want to be pitied. Perhaps this is a mask that I'm choosing to wear in public. It's complicated. Sometimes I feel as if I am a boat floundering in a stormy sea. I've lost my compass, and I can't find my home port. I'm frantically looking for the light at the end of the dock, but the fog is too thick, and there's no one waiting for me. That's the worst part. My work has been my salvation. During the 3 months of daily hospital vigils, I travel between two opposing worlds. One is tearing me apart, and the other is putting me back together again. The hospital is an alien place, with suffocating corridors filled with strangers, carts loaded with medical supplies, and the sickening smell of bleach. The medical staff go about their routines, desensitized and sanitized. In contrast, my office at the university is my solace. The hallways are filled with people I know who respect me and truly care about my well-being. There's predictable routine and normalcy here. My inquisitive mind, my curiosity, my questions, and my ability to probe deeply for information are valued here. Ironically, these same dispositions are ignored, trivialized, and often resented at the hospital. The medical hierarchy is controlling, condescending, and aloof. It retains power by withholding information and keeping me in the dark. I constantly feel patronized and put down. The hospital expects me to be passive and compliant. There's one chair by the bed. That's where I'm expected to stay. Don't bother the nurses and don't ask for the doctors. Stay out of their way. My husband has become their property, and I have lost my status. I am a nuisance, a bother. I'm invisible. As my husband's self-appointed advocate, I am confronted with an overwhelming array of complex medical terms and forced to learn a new language quickly. I remind myself that I am strong, independent, and resilient. I am determined to do whatever it is I have to do. I escape to chapters to look for books about strokes. A million emotions hang from me like wet towels: fear, confusion, uncertainty, guilt, anger, frustration, disbelief, sadness, abandonment. I wander aimlessly through the aisles. A sales clerk finds me there and offers to help. Lily is a buxom, middle-aged woman who wears a broad smile and two buttons on her smock. Vampire lady and bite me. I'm drawn to her. She seems kind. In spite of myself, I pour out my story and I cry openly for the first time, gratefully accepting a hug from the stranger in the middle of the bookstore. She envelopes me in genuine care. Her simple gesture really helps. We find the reference section, and I buy 7 books. I take them home, devour them, trespassing into forbidden territory, a rebellious act of sheer defiance. Making sense of unfamiliar information is what I know how to do. My left brain kicks into gear. I crawl up into my head, where I feel comfortable and at ease. I abandon my body and I turn off my right brain. I bury all my emotions, willing my logic and objective reality to take over, to rescue me. This is a safe place, and I'm home here. I reclaim some of my identity. I begin to keep a journal of my new role as defiant advocate and intrepid trespasser. I meticulously record new vocabulary and concepts from my reading, as well as my daily hospital encounters. I learn to feel more confident communicating with the medical lexicon. Arterial fibrillation, infarction, intubation, paresthesia, aphasia, visual agnosia, and fibrosarcoma. Did it. I make a list of best practices for visitors based on first-hand experiences of stroke survivor Jill Bolt and tape it to the wall over my husband's bed. I bring family photographs and a CD player to bring music into this room. I take back this alien space and I empower myself. Now I move into the bits from his journal, which I'm just going to read a couple of. But I call this section Bearing Witness to Death, the gush. The other was the trickle. And I certainly didn't intend to write about this. February 23rd, Fred's left hand, the only one that still functions, is restrained. It's tied to the bed frame with a strong buckle and lock. He looks like a prisoner. They look like handcuffs. I'm mortified. He keeps pulling out the feeding tube, possibly the only control he has right now. All I can do is swab his mouth with a small green sponge soaked in mouthwash. I'm told to squeeze out the excess liquid so he does not aspirate. He can't even swallow properly. March 6th, Fred had surgery to insert permanent feeding tube. I was supposed to be notified. I wasn't. I'm furious. I wanted to be there. I storm down to the nursing station and wait impatiently for the nurse to look up from her paperwork. In a cheery voice, she informs me, "It all went very well, honey." "F off," I scream to her in my head. "I am not your honey." I'm livid. I have a meltdown. I've tried so hard not to do this. Now they'll take it out on us. They will retaliate by paying less attention to Fred. I will be labeled as a troublemaker. I'm not following the rules. I insist on a team meeting. I need to know their best guess. I need information. I can't keep relying on the internet. March 7th. The team meeting was awful. So patronizing and disrespectful. The young caseworker makes it very clear that the hospital staff assembled around the table are very busy people and that I should be grateful that they have agreed to interrupt their important schedules for my benefit. When she refers to Fred as the stroke, I swallow hard and remind her that he has a name and I would appreciate it if she would use it. She stares me down hard. I stare right back. She relents. I fume. Skip to one more here. April 28th, this is a very bad day. Fred grabs the bed rail and shakes it vigorously like a caged animal, a prisoner. He keeps pulling off the bed sheet, revealing his bony, skinny legs. He stares at me with a very angry expression, grabs my arm and pulls me towards him. Then he punches me. I try not to take this personally. Why is he lashing out at me? June 3rd, 8:10 a.m. Death is not easy. It is a struggle to leave this realm, just as it is a struggle to be born. The family and I hold vigil. No one tells us how to do this. At Fred's moment of passing, I feel the energy, the universe rejoice. I shout, "You did it!" I actually shout. I feel extreme euphoria. I have witnessed a rebirth. A profound transformation. It is magical. I'm holding his left hand with one of mine and have my other hand on his chest. I feel his heart beating slowly until there is no more. I whisper in his ear, "You did it," recalling the beautiful images from the Irish poet John O'Donohue. I envision a slow wind enveloping Fred like an invisible cloak. I wish for him a flock of colors to dance across and a path of yellow moonlight to bring him safely home. On the table beside the bed, I notice a yellow hibiscus has bloomed this morning. This is Fred's favorite flower. Each bloom lasts for only one day before folding in on itself and falling off. I no longer fear death. Although death has such an intense permanence, eternity is another possibility, and time is no more than an idea. Fred left me with this gift of amazing insight that will help me navigate my own diminishment one day. As my physical capabilities are taken away, I will get lighter, and eventually I will become light enough to float away and reconnect with the vastness of the universe, where I belong. Writing this auto-narrative has been illuminating. I repeatedly describe the hospital as an alien place. I portray Fred as a prisoner of both his stroke and the system, handcuffed to a bed. I describe the recreation of my identity as I constantly patched together the confidence to believe in my opinions and decisions. I've been forced to confront the essence of who I am and to gain a clearer image of who I am becoming. I have known loss and struggled out of its depths. My sense of individuality, resilience, and strength has been confirmed. I now experience life with more compassion. I welcome contemplation and its benefits. I've come home to myself, and there is comfort in knowing this place is home. I'm learning to embrace the untapped potential of my inner world and dance to its rhythm. In doing so, I am gaining a deeper appreciation of the power of silence and the blessing of solitude as a creative space. I am beginning to understand that only in solitude can I truly listen to my body. In solitude, my body speaks the loudest. Sometimes my body speaks to me through pain, anger, and guilt. But these emotions must not be pushed away or ignored. They come for a reason. I've also gained a profound insight about the beauty of death, a time when something eternal happens in our very presence and reveals itself to us. Fred did not embark on this journey by himself. I was on this journey with him. I just did not know it.